Last time we got through the fifth chapter of Nehemiah, and so tonight we'd like to start with Nehemiah chapter 6. The context here is that the work is progressing quite well on the rebuilding of the wall of Jerusalem. In the fifth chapter, there were some problems in which one group was being unfair to the poorer group of Jews, so Nehemiah settled that, and he got them to repay the usury and the unfair goods that had been taken. And then as we begin in chapter 6, we're going to see how the enemies of the church continue to try to bring about the downfall of the success of the rebuilding of the wall. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, then Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, now when the people who live round about Judea, the enemies of the church, that is, they're foreigners, they're aliens, they serve another god besides the true God, they have other purposes in mind besides the purpose of establishing the worship of the true God. When they learned that that he had builded the wall and that there was no breach or no hole or no defect left in it, then they wanted to use another method by which they could bring about the downfall of this project. Verse 2, then Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. Their first purpose was, you come and leave Judea, or leave the sanctity of the walls of Jerusalem, and let's meet in a village somewhere, and let's discuss this matter. Let's talk about our differences. And he says they thought to do me mischief. Now, we don't know exactly what they were going to do, whether they were going to do some kind of physical harm to Nehemiah, whether they were going to kidnap him, or put him to death, or put him in prison, or just exactly what their plans were, but he says they thought to do me mischief. Now, we learn from this that they had no intention of allowing Nehemiah to go on with the work as it should be done. Their plans were to do something that shouldn't be done. And I think we can derive a great lesson from this. When we're carrying out the work of God and somebody wants to call us away from that, sidetrack us from that, for another purpose, then their purpose is not going to be according to what God wants. And I think of this a lot of times when somebody decides they want to just argue about something, and they have an argument or a debate. They have no intention whatsoever of trying to learn or trying to change or trying to seek after the truth. All they want to do is to hold up their point to bolster their doctrine, and all of that time it's spent doing that is really futile time, and it's time it's wasted. And so the way Nehemiah handled this situation was, in verse 3, and I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Now they probably knew that as long as Nehemiah was involved talking with them or having some kind of relationship with them, that he couldn't oversee the work of the wall, and so this work would have to lag. So he sends back the answer, why should I leave this great work and come down to you? I cannot come down. I'm doing a great work. Verse 4, yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Now, they didn't give up. They kept trying to lure Nehemiah away from this work of God. trying to get him out of the confines of Jerusalem. And we find that the world does the same thing to us today. It would like to get us away from the church. The world would like to get us away from our work as a professed Christian. It would like to cause us to leave the safety of the walls of Jerusalem and become involved in some other activity, some other endeavor, under the pretext that they're trying to get together with us, that they're trying to do something that would ease our conflicts. But any time we have to compromise with the world, then we have just let down on our duty to God. So they sent after him four times in this way, and he answered them the same way each of the four times. So they were unsuccessful. Even though they were persistent, they were unsuccessful in luring Nehemiah away from the city of God. And so we today must also be just as tenacious as Nehemiah was in holding to the precepts and to the duty and to the shelter that we receive in the kingdom of God as Nehemiah was. Verse 5, then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand. Now they tried four times to get him to come down and leave Jerusalem, and they were unsuccessful. So the fifth time they tried another trick. He said he sent his servant with an open letter in his hand. Now this idea of an open letter was really an insult to somebody as high in the nation as Nehemiah was. When you have the head of one nation approaching the head of another nation, especially in the that part of the country, then a communication would be sealed and sent in a dignified manner. But here he sent a servant with an open letter, as though it could just be read by anybody that he came in contact with. Maybe he passed it around to some other people before it ever got to Nehemiah. And this is what the letter said, verse 6, wherein was written, it is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel. Now that's the way this letter starts, that the heathen are saying, and of course what he means by that is other nations are saying, and one of the leaders called Gashmu was the one who was really saying it, who was really verifying that this was true, that thou and the Jews think to rebel. What is being said about you all is that you're building this wall so you can rebel against the kingdom that has sent you over here, the Persian government, and so you're rebels to the great king, and consequently, this is the word that's being spread about you. Now, you can see how this would put Nehemiah on the defensive immediately. Here's a charge that he was trying to rebel against and overthrow that part of the government, which was an untrue charge, but it would put him on the defensive. Notice further what it said. For which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judea. And now it shall be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, let us take counsel together. Now, so the letter just simply accused Nehemiah and his nation of trying to rebel against the Persian government, of Nehemiah trying to become a king in his own right among these people, and saying that they should look upon him as the king. And he had even sent prophets there to preach that he was the king, to spread the news that he was the king, so that he would be a rival to the Persian king. So after having said these things that would put Nehemiah on the defensive, he says, come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. This was another means then to lure Nehemiah away. Come and talk to us. Come and let's reason about this. Well, the first impulse anybody might have would be to say, well, sure, let me go down and explain this. Let me go down and justify myself and show that this is not true. But you see, what would have happened had Nehemiah done this, had he had come to reason and to counsel with Sanballat about this, then it would have actually given the appearance that Sanballat might be right, and Nehemiah was trying to negotiate and compromise. And so this is another tactic the world may use. False accusations. Accusations that are so false that we'll just bend over backwards to try to prove that they're not true. And so here's the reaction that Nehemiah had in verse 8. Then I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. You made these up. You manufactured these charges. Nothing like this is being done, like you're saying. And so this is just simply a way that Nehemiah had of telling them that the charges are not true. You manufacture these charges. Verse 9. For they all made us afraid, saying, their hands shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. So one of the ways that they were making God's people afraid was just by predicting and by flatly stating that your hands are going to be weakened from the work. That is, you're not going to be able to do this work. You've undertaken a job that you cannot accomplish. We're going to see that you don't do it. So his last sentence there in that verse is, now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. And this should be our retort to our accusers. When they say that we're not going to be able to do something that God has said for us to do, that we're going to be too weak, we're going to be too unable to carry it out, simply pray to God for strength. And so it says, now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Give my hands strength to do the thing that we need to do. So we begin to see then how the enemies of Nehemiah are incessantly working, using devious means, subtle ways to try to get him to stop the work or to slow down the work. They don't just come right out and say all the time that we're going to fight, all the time we're going to put a physical halt to you. There are other means. Now, we learned in a previous chapter that they had threatened physical warfare, that they did have to when they built this wall. They had one man standing guard and one man building, or one man building with one hand and holding a weapon with another hand. And they'd work by day and they'd stand guard by night. They didn't even go to their houses. They were protecting against the physical threat. But then there are also these mental other threats that are more subtle, that are disguised, that Nehemiah also had to be on the lookout for. And we're going to even see some more before this chapter's over. Afterwards, verse 10, I came unto the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut up. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night will they come to slay thee. Now here's a person, this Shemaiah, who was some kind of a recluse. He kept himself shut up. He stayed confined in or about the temple, or in about his house. And so his approach to Nehemiah was, you come with me and let us go in together into the house of God within the temple. Let us shut the doors of the temple, and because they're going to come to slay you. They're going to come in the night to slay thee, and this will give you protection. Just come with me and let me close you up in the temple in a safe place, and then nobody can get to you. They cannot slay you. Now on the surface, that might sound like a good idea. It might sound like that here's a person who really has the best interest of Nehemiah at heart. But Nehemiah saw through this. Here was someone pretending to be his friend, someone who was on the inside, so to speak, of the church, who was being used by the forces of evil to try to tear down the work of Nehemiah. Verse 11, and I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Now, the temple was not made for that purpose. It wasn't made for the purpose of hiding from the work of God. The temple was made for the purpose of worshiping God. It was a house of God, not a place to go stop your work and hide and seek safety. And so he said, should such a man as I flee? Who is there being as I am would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Now you see how this could apply to us today. We might become so involved in some of the things of the church that we really begin to neglect the Christian life. We neglect those that might need us to teach them. We neglect those that might need us to help them in some other ways, maybe with food or clothing or shelter, or maybe with hospitality. We can become so engrossed that we have secluded ourselves to the narrow confines of the church that we don't make any contact with those whom we might help, and consequently we're not doing the work of God. There are others who become so involved in the ritualistic things of the church that they never study. They never grow in that sense. They've got some of the basic things of the gospel down, and that's it. They don't have to grow anymore. They just stay within the same rut all the time. They are secluded from new truths, from new ideas. And I say new in the sense that they're new to this person because they haven't discovered them yet. They're old in the sense that they've been here all along. But they're in a rut. And it could have looked ever so sanctimonious for Nehemiah to have been secluded over in the temple. Somebody said, where's Nehemiah? Well, he's in the temple. But really what he would have been doing is hiding from and refusing to do the work that God had planned for him to do. And so he says, I won't do this. The temple's not made for this. I'm not going to the temple to hide. I will not go in. And so it is with us today in the church. It's not a place for us to hide. It's not a place for us to bury our head in the sand, so to speak. It's not a place for us to get out of the mainstream of the activity that God would have his people to do. That's losing the whole side of everything. And there may be some who would say, yes, do this. You just stay in this little narrow rut that you're in here, and do not worry about studying other parts of the Bible. Do not worry about making other applications. Do not worry about examining whether or not our practice is really according to God's way. Just stay here. And don't get yourself in any kind of trouble. Don't do anything that somebody might raise an eyebrow about or question at all. But just do the old traditions that we've always had. There's many ways you could apply this. And so Nehemiah says, I will not go in. Verse 12, and lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Now here was a man telling Nehemiah to do this, who had been hired by the enemy. Therefore was he hired, that I should be afraid, and do so, and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Now, he would have had neglected the work on the wall. He would have had to have shown that he was really afraid, that he did not trust in God. Many, many things that would have been manifested by this, and simply because he had been deceived by someone who had been hired by the opposition. Now, I'd like to say just a word here about this business of being hired. Therefore was he hired. The Bible speaks about someone who is a hireling as though the hireling is not going to take care of the sheep like the true shepherd does. A hireling is just being paid to work out here by the day or by the hour, by the week. And he's working for the money. He's working for the job that he has, and not necessarily for the true benefit and the true good of the sheep or the flock. And so it is with those who are hired today to do the things of the church. They are at a very great disadvantage, because they are dependent upon the ones who pay their salaries. They're dependent upon them to like what they do, to be pleased with what they do, or they will be fired from their job. There are many disadvantages to being a hireling. A person who has a position, which we do not recognize as being scriptural in the church today, a position known as being a pastor of a congregation, who's been hired to come there to do the preaching, been hired to come there to do the personal work, hired to come there to go and visit the sick, and to carry on the main items of the worship service, this person is at a very great disadvantage, because if he learns a new truth that that congregation doesn't have, he almost never will be able to propagate that truth, because when he does, they're going to fire him, because he is dependent upon those people liking what he says in order for them to keep on paying him. And he really is a hireling in that sense. He can't be concerned about the flock. He has to be concerned about the one who hired him, or the ones who hired him. And so we want to be careful about getting ourselves into a position of being a hireling. We work in the church because it is our life. We do it because we love it. We do it because we don't have any choice, really, for Christians. Paul says, "Woe unto me if I preach not the gospel." And the same is true of us and our work in the church. Woe would be in us if we don't do it. Have to do it for pay? Why, nonsense. We do it because we must do it. And when we do it in that mind and in that spirit, then we have the freedom to do as Nehemiah did, to not cause ourselves to be shut up in the temple, to not cause ourselves to have to hide or to flee or to leave the work. We can be free to carry out the work of God as we see that it should be done. So that's just a little aside that I thought of as I think of this man being hired. Therefore was he hired, that I should be afraid and do so in sin, that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Verse 14. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear. Now this verse is simply a way that Nehemiah has of asking God to remember those who were trying to do this to him. Sanballat, Tobiah, and then he names a prophetess, Noadiah. And some of the scholars say that this should not be prophetess, but it should be a prophet. And so I don't know. It doesn't really matter so far as the meaning is concerned here. And, of course, we know that God does remember the works of those who are wicked as well as the works of those who are righteous. And Nehemiah just simply asking God to remember their works. Think on them. Verse 15. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. Now this is somewhere in the vicinity of our September, August and September, I believe it is, and it was 52 days. Now this was a tremendous job to rebuild this wall. We cannot really comprehend the greatness of the work to rebuild this wall around the city of Jerusalem. And it's amazing that they could have done it in 52 days. But the way Nehemiah talks, they worked day and night. They worked at night guarding it and daytime building it. They didn't even have a chance to take their clothes off. And so it was a tremendous effort to do. But as we think about it, they probably didn't have to quarry any stone. All the stone may have already been here and been available. It was just a matter of cleaning up the debris and the trash and putting back what had already been there. It was really a repairing the wall. And also, let us not forget that God was with them. We're going to talk about that a little further. But they rebuilt it in 52 days. Verse 16, and it came to pass that when our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. So the enemies were much cast down when they saw it. They were crestfallen before God's people had truly gained the victory just by being able to build a wall around their city. Now today, we have truly gained the victory just by being able to establish a faithful congregation, wherever that might be. Doesn't matter where it is. If it's a faithful congregation, we have gained the victory. And God's enemies will look upon that, and they will not be pleased to know about it or to see it. They're almost invariably displeased to see a faithful congregation go. And what has really happened is that a wall has been built around Jerusalem when a faithful congregation has been built. And also what has happened is that this work was wrought of our God. It is a work that is brought about by God. Man alone cannot do it. It's not intended that man be able to do it. Just like it seems impossible that they could have built that wall in 52 days, it was God that brought about the work. And also, when the enemies truly see that it is a work of God, that God does bring about the work, this gives them discouragement. And it's our purpose and our endeavor to show that our lives and our works are according to what God wants. When we start trying to rationalize and justify our efforts on the basis of it being according to what man wants and what we want, what we think is right, and do not go to the Bible to justify our every act, then we put ourselves on the same plane as Sanballat and Tobiah. We're just no better than they, because they are going on what they think is right rather than what God thinks is right. We must let it be the work of God. It must be God's work. When we built the wall, it must be God's work and not our work that's done it. Now we're going to see some more problems beginning in verse 17. Moreover, in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. Now here's an additional problem. Not only did Nehemiah have to contend with his enemies on the outside, but he also had enemies within. Here it talks about the nobles of Judah, some of the higher people among the children of God, some of the higher people, the nobles of Judah, were sending letters to Tobiah, and Tobiah sending letters to them. They had a communication going here, a communication with the world. Now, you might ask, why was this? How did this happen? Why did such a situation as this exist? Well, we'll see how it happened. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah. And his son, Johanan, had taken the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Now what this really is saying here is that the reason that they were so closely connected with Tobiah, the reason they were sworn to him, the reason they had such a close communication with him and a loyalty to him, was because there had been some intermarrying going on. He was the son-in-law of Shechaniah. We read about Shechaniah back in Ezra. He was the one that said, well, let's just get rid of all these wives. You know, he proposed this to Ezra. But I don't know if this is the same Shechaniah or not. It doesn't really matter. But he was a son-in-law of one. And then some of his son had then taken the daughter of another one of the Jews. So there was intermarriage and a relationship established through a family tie. Well, you know, that we discussed that back in Ezra, how that this was most displeasing to God, how that it diluted the people and their ability to remain pure to God, true to God. And so we see here one of the results of it, and that is that it caused these people to have an allegiance to Tobiah simply because there was a kind of a kinship bond. One of them could say, well, he's my son-in-law. He married my daughter, and his children are my grandchildren. See what a wedge that opens up. And I found that even today, for example, many times doctrinal questions may be decided by an individual on the basis of how the family stands and how the family practices. I remember, for example, some 20, 25 years ago when the great question was raging through the church about divorce and remarriage. There was the question, is it lawful for a Christian to divorce and remarry? And there was a division, came about in the church because of it. But many congregations and many families I observed who really had felt all along that they shouldn't divorce and remarry, when it came right down to it in a matter of what the preachers were going to do and who to fellowship and who not to fellowship, when they would have a son or a daughter that was divorced and remarried, or they had a relative, or they had a parent, or they had a brother or a sister, and they started looking at what it would mean if they did not go that way, they were swayed by those family ties. And so we have to be very careful about that. We must not be swayed by family ties when there's a conflict with what God teaches. And that's what happened here in Jerusalem. Because the family ties were so strong, they kept a communication going up with Tobiah against Nehemiah. So verse 19, also they reported his good deed before me and uttered my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to put me in fear. So every move that Nehemiah made, they told Tobiah about it. He knew what Nehemiah was doing because these men were writing the letters. And then everything that Tobiah wanted to do to influence people in his direction and against Nehemiah, they were listening, they had the letters, they communicated. And so you see then, this is an example of having enemies from within. People inside the church that are dragging the church down because they have the communication with the world. And it happens even today. All you have to do is to have more communication and more love for and more association with the world than you do the church. And first thing you know, you're thinking the way the world's thinking, and you're out of step with the way the church is thinking. And so you may be saying some things to these worldly people that run down church members and giving them fuel for their fight against the church. And you're really not on the side of the church because you're so closely related to and communicative with the world that you're really more like the world than you are like the church, and you're kind of on the fence. That's what happened here. And it went against Nehemiah, and it's recorded in God's Word about it. Now, we're ready to start into chapter 7.